And then there are some injuries that different species of trees respond to differently. So the amount of live crown volume that is scorched, different trees can handle that differently. How much of the circumference of the bole is charred, and there's a difference between char and scorch. Char is deep injury that will damage the cambium underneath. The height of the scorch, how high above the ground did the fire reach that lethal temperature, and how much of the duff, the debris on the ground, was consumed. The ratings are different for different species, and not every species has really been looked at. But a lot of them have. So ponderosa pine, Douglas fir, Angleton spruce, lodgepole pine, western larch, the white firs, grand fir and white fir, subalpine fir, and western white pine. These have all been looked at specifically for how much damage they can take as a species, and you know it differs by age and size also, because trees change over time. So the season of the fire matters, as I said, because trees can tolerate less when they are growing actively. And late season is considered after about August 1st for most trees. And the reason is, it's at about that time that trees have set their buds. And if you look at a tree in the fall, the late summer, early fall, the buds will then be covered with scales and they will be hard. You won't have actively growing succulent tissues. And so they can tolerate a lot more heat after those terminal buds have formed. If you actually look in this book, which when we go outside, I'll pass a couple of these books around, you'll see that he states that an early season prescribed burn might not damage trees at all. Studies really have shown that a burn is a burn. And if you're a fire manager and you do a good job, you can, in fact, keep trees alive better, but if things don't go right, a burn is a burn. So the pre-fire vigor, and actually young trees, assuming that they've got their bark well developed, young trees that are growing fast have the best chance of recovering. And old slow-growing trees, so what's the reason for that? Old slow-growing trees may have an advantage in having thicker bark, but they really, I talked earlier, talking about bark beetles, trees have different ways of allocating their nutrient, and those photosynthetic that's available for tissue repair is not the first priority. The first priority is just respiration and retaining the live tissues that are there. When trees are scorched, if it's a big old tree, it still has a lot of live tissue to support, and it may have lost some of its crown, and it may not have quite as much available for things like repair and defense if bark beetles are in the area. Feel free to stop me if you have a question. The downwind material that's on the ground, if it's up against the tree, can really conduct a lot of heat to the stem and to the roots too. And when we go out and take a look at this, sometimes it's like an investigation, because it can be hard to tell what was on the ground before the fire if you had a very intense fire. And I threw that picture in there because if you look to the right of that tree, that's a stump hole. And that's a stump hole that has burned out, and then there's white ash. Sometimes we call this a cigarette burn. If you can see that line of white ash next to the tree underneath what would have been the drip line, that was a log that burned out. And it left that line of white ash. And if you can see that, you can think to yourself, that may have held heat there for rather a long time.
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
So you said earlier on that one of the factors determining whether a tree's going to survive is what happens to all the organic debris around the tree?
Yes.
Is that why?
Yes, it's because of the heat that can be transferred to the roots, the surface roots, and also to the bole of the tree that.
So if you see a lot of debris that's made it through the fire, that means that it didn't have, there wasn't as much heat going down to the roots.
It's all part of that investigation. If it's not burned at all,
right,
then you might say, well, that didn't transfer heat. But if it's charred, you can assume that there was resident heat there maybe for a while. Yeah, I'm hoping that some of you will go out with me and look around because it's complicated. It takes a little time. And as foresters go out and try to make these determinations, usually when I work with people who are going to do this, and why would you do it at all? You would do it because you're gonna take some action. You're gonna remove some of these trees. You don't go out and evaluate whether a tree is gonna survive or not, and then just say, well, there you go. Unless you're doing a research study. So then you would, and then you'd come back several times and over a period of years. But sometimes a forest manager will say, well, I always intended to manage this for timber, and now it's burned, and so what I want to do is take out, I only want to leave trees that have a really high probability of surviving. And so we run through the process and we give the trees their various ratings and we mark them to take or leave. Others may say, well, I only want to take out the ones that are highly likely to die because I'm willing to take the risk of having some stay there and die. I need some for bluebird nesting or whatever.
So a salvage logging permit might be an example of using this survey, and you want to make sure that somebody that knows is marking the most likely surviving trees.
Exactly.
And the rest you're going to salvage because you want to get something out of your timber that you're
managing. In fact, I had a situation where I was called out because there had already been partial logging. And then there was a fire. Well, you know, they left the trees that they wanted to leave, and now a bunch of them were burned. And so they didn't want to take any that were likely to survive. So what they did was they took out all the ones that were highly likely to die and left the rest. But other managers would do something different. But yeah, salvage logging is usually what happens, or maybe it's your campground or, you know, your buildings that you want to look at. But if you're doing a large area, there comes a point where you have to say, all right, I've looked at 25 Douglas firs here of a certain size, and I'm getting the picture of which ones are going to rate out how high. And then you have to move along a little faster. So usually we'll spend lots of time with the first few trees and then get an idea of what's going on out there. But so this is dwarf mistletoe. This is dwarf mistletoe. It is a parasitic plant. For those of you who haven't seen it before, the plant itself is pretty small. Well, it varies. I have put up here Douglas fir dwarf mistletoe because that's what you're going to see outside. There's lots of Douglas fir dwarf mistletoe. The plant itself is smaller really than the needles of the tree. So you see that picture on the right? It's a parasitic plant, and it sends a message to the tree to send the nutrients to the plant, and the tree will nourish the plant in preference to other tissues. What very often happens is you'll get, so on the left here, there's a picture of a Douglas fir that is almost entirely infested with dwarf mistletoe. You can see that the top of the tree is really starting to get thin because the tree's not growing anymore. All it's doing is feeding that dwarf mistletoe plant. And this really impacts tree vigor over time. And ponderosa pine has its own dwarf mistletoe, which looks different from Douglas fir dwarf mistletoe, but again, it really impacts tree vigor, and it has a very detrimental effect on the survivability of ponderosa pine, which is too bad, because ponderosa pine, in terms of surviving fire, is the best tree. It's really very fire tolerant, but less so if it has dwarf mistletoe. And just for those of you who haven't gone through this, because we will go through this outside, this is how you rake dwarf mistletoe. It's really a well-known technique to foresters.
So that previous picture is probably, what, 5 or 6 on the scale?
It would certainly be a 6. Every third of that, so you've done this before.
Yep.
Yeah, every third of that tree was infested. So if you see 2 brooms on a third of the tree, that gets up 2. And visually, you divide the crown into thirds, and then you say, well, each third gets a rating, and the maximum rating is a 6. And a 6 would really mean that whole tree is infested with dwarf mistletoe. And the more infestation it has, the more of an impact it has on the tree's ability to survive. Yes?
So the picture you showed us with the tree on the left, so all that green growth on it that looks so unusual, was that dwarf mistletoe, or was that just the tree responding to the dwarf mistletoe by growing like crazy? Wherever?
That's the tree's response. What it is it's sending nutrients to the plant, and the tree is not putting on any diameter growth. It's not putting on any height growth. It's just nourishing that dwarf mistletoe plant. And dwarf mistletoe, I'm going to go back there. So in those little plants, in the tip of each of those little plants, is a seed pod. And those seed pods are full of liquid. And as the seed itself matures, it becomes bigger, and it gets under a lot of pressure in that seed pod, until finally, when the seed is fully ripe, that pod bursts, and the seed is shot out at really high pressure, and it goes up, and then it goes out. And then, if it's lucky, it will land on the needle of a host species. So Douglas fir dwarf mistletoe has to infect Douglas fir. Ponderosa pine dwarf mistletoe has to infect ponderosa pine. They're really well adapted to their host. But once a tree gets this much dwarf mistletoe, it's probably not infecting the trees around it anymore, because the plants are all in these terrific brooms that the tree has developed, and that's what these are called. They're called witch's brooms. So at this point, the tree is probably just reinfesting itself. So the brooms are just getting bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. And it can eventually kill the tree. It can kill the tree by just starving it. But the last thing that's going to die is the mistletoe broom itself. The top will die. And then gradually, the tree just won't be able to translocate. It won't be able to feed those brooms anymore. But it's a slow process. I think of it as tree cancer.
Those brooms are also, especially when it's a 5 or 6 like that, that is a tremendous ember catcher and generator.
Yep. They can get very resinous mm-hmm. in there. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's all kinds of fine fuel that's caught in there. And people who model fire behavior have an extension for the model for the presence of Douglas fir dwarf mistletoe. Because not only does it do that to the tree, but you think about in the winter, those will fill up with snow and ice, and they get very heavy, and they'll fall out of the tree. So they'll then wound the tree. They'll fall out of the tree, fall on the ground, and then you have ground fuel, too. So that can be part of that process when the fire burns. Yeah, dwarf mistletoe, particularly in Douglas fir, just changes the whole ecology of the tree when it gets infested. In fact, that's a whole lecture in itself.
Well, my final question on this then.
Yes.
If you're in an area where you want to manage this, what is the treatment for that dwarf mistletoe?
Well, dwarf mistletoe is an obligate parasite, and it also is somewhat limited in how far it can spread. Usually we figure about 35 feet it will spread from one tree to another, and it will only spread to the host species. And there are reasons why you might want to have this tree, if you had this tree, because birds really like to nest in these. And in fact, northern spotted owl, that's its preferred nesting material, is Douglas fir dwarf mistletoe blooms.
I can point out a tree where I left the brooms because of that.
Yeah. But you don't want to try growing Douglas fir around that, because it will spread to other Douglas firs around it. And if a young Douglas fir gets infested with dwarf mistletoe early in its life, it just will never get big. It will turn into, it'll look like a cabbage plant.
So you're basically talking about removing the 5 and 6 infested trees and then limbing out the brooms.
You can prune it, not when it gets like this.
No.
Yeah. But it does, if you have a tree that, say just the bottom of this tree were infested, you could prune out those brooms, and that really does relieve a lot of the stress on the tree, not having to support those brooms. You're probably not going to remove all the dwarf mistletoe. Over time, the tree will probably, you'll probably see that you missed it, and there's more. But if you want to just extend the life of a tree, for instance, a campground tree or an ornamental tree, you can do that. You can do that by pruning it. So dwarf mistletoe, yes, it affects the tree's ability to survive fire injuries. And it also may just increase the fire activity around the tree. So root disease, and if it's on the site. And the reason that we say on the site is because it's very difficult to tell if the tree itself had root disease, particularly once the fire has gone. Root diseases of true firs and Douglas firs, we really consider them diseases of the site. They're in the soil. They feed on the roots of trees. They're fungi. They move around in the soil. They feed on the roots of trees. They can be slow killers. And sometimes trees will lose so much root that they'll fall over, still green. Depends on the root disease. You kind of have to know whether there was root disease on your site before the fire, or you have to see signs of it after the fire. But it does affect tree vigor in the long term. So if a tree is injured and there's root disease on the site, it can make that root disease more active. And the trees that were not killed will then be affected by the fungus as well as by their injuries. It's good if you know your site and if you can answer that question. Also, bark beetle populations are usually higher on root diseased sites. And there's usually more downwood. So this is a picture of, this is a grand fir site that has heterobasidian root disease. It used to be called anosis root disease, which was easier to pronounce. I'm not a pathologist, so I lost the battle trying to keep the old name. But so this is the kind of thing that you'll have before the fire. And then if that burns, obviously it just had a lot more downwood debris on the site.
If you get a hot fire on the topsoils, will it burn out a lot of that fungus growth and sterilize that?
You'll want to think that it might, but the reality is, that fungus is deep in the soil. And if you did somehow get a fire that was hot enough to really burn out fungus that's in the soil, you've got a very damaging fire going on there, and you probably don't have any trees that have survived. So bark beetle pressure, I think I've kind of talked about this already. If damaged trees really emit these terpenes that attract bark beetles, and then as soon as a few bark beetles find those trees, they start emitting these terrific pheromones that attract other beetles in. Again, it has to be, if you have Douglas fir beetle in the area and only ponderosa pine survived in the fire, then you don't need to worry about it. It has to be a beetle that can affect the tree that you're concerned about. But beetles can build up and damage trees. Usually we say if the infestation is within a quarter of a mile, that would substantially increase the risk. Now this is the factor. I'm going to turn off these lights. This is the thing that is readily visible to anybody, is how much of the crown volume is scorched. And we have found over time that if that's the only factor you use, that has your greatest ability to be correct about whether or not the tree is going to survive. So, you know, when a crown is scorched, obviously the tree has lost photosynthetic area. However, so this tree, this is a ponderosa pine, probably, well, it got scorched on one side. Most of the limbs down at the bottom were scorched. And further up, so on the uphill side, it looks like there was some convective heat that scorched the outer needles of that tree. But probably overall, you know, it's not more than 15% of the volume, the total volume. And those lower branches are not the most actively photosynthesizing ones. They're shaded. And really, as when the tree loses those, you know, it's probably a little bit of photosynthesis is lost, but really, that's less live tissue it has to support. Less live tissue, it's lost some buds there. That small amount of crown volume scorch is not going to affect its survivability substantially at all. And ponderosa pine really can tolerate a lot of crown scorch, especially late in the season when the buds have set. And my really surprising experience with a situation like that was 2 years after the tripod fire. I went back with a crew that was looking at some of these dead trees, trying to determine how much deterioration there had been. This was 2 years after the fire. There was going to be some salvage of these fire-damaged trees. Well, it's 2 years later. We wanted to look at how much deterioration there had been. We cut one ponderosa pine that was about 18 inches in diameter, and it did not have a live needle on it that you could see. We got it down on the ground, and it was green. And at the top, there was a live bud that had just started to candle, and there were a few needles. Now, I don't think that tree had much of a future, but it had lived 2 years with almost no needles at all. So ponderosa pine can be pretty tolerant.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
How is that possible? I mean, like, what makes the ponderosa pine so tolerant? I mean, so like after the season, but like, that's pretty extreme.
2 years. It was pretty extreme. I think it was pretty unusual. And so that, what probably happened, so there were some needles at the top. Mm-hmm. We couldn't see them. The tree was 85 feet tall. We couldn't see them. It had a few live buds at the top. And clearly it wasn't growing. I mean, it hadn't put on any diameter growth. It hadn't, but it had put on a little bit of height growth. It's like on life supports, but I wouldn't use that as a decision point for other trees. It's unusual, but it can happen. Yeah, ponderosa pine is pretty remarkable that way. So I looked at this yesterday with some of you, at bole char of these trees. So this is really, you estimate how much circumference of the tree is likely to have cambium damage. So live tissues under under the bark damage. And this is very time consuming, or can be. So this is the kind of thing where you might take a hatchet and go underneath this bark on several trees of certain size and species, and after a while you say, okay, this is a Douglas fir, it's 19 inches in diameter. You can see right here that the bark that we refer to as sort of melted. The bark has lost its normal configuration. So that now where it would have been bark that had a lot of ridges, now it's looking kind of smooth, sort of melted. There's probably a little pitching down there at the base of the tree. So we'll take a hatchet and chop a little bit out of there and see if there's live cambium underneath it. You don't choose that little area where it looks the worst. You choose a sort of average area, and you might do that in two or three different places at the base of the tree and see whether that cambium is pink and healthy or whether it's brown, and sometimes it even smells kind of fermented. You can't be doing that to every single tree, but you can get an idea of what's happening out there with all your other factors that you're considering. On the right is a grand fir. It's a young grand fir. It's a thin-barked species, and it doesn't take much, even for rather large grand firs. Doesn't take much at the base. I remember looking at one grand fir that had just a frill, maybe a couple inches, all around the base, and all around the base, all of that was cooked. It was dead. The tree had been girdled by fire. So it depends on species and how thick the bark is. And bark thickness is really the key. So here are a couple that I chopped into. The one on the left, that's live cambium underneath the scorched bark. And on the right, that's what dead cambium looks like. Sometimes, if you look at that immediately after the fire, it can be a little bit difficult to tell, but it has a kind of smell to it. It just smells fermented and cooked. The total scorch height is the height all the way from the ground where a lethal temperature was reached. And really, this is kind of a surrogate measurement for the intensity of the fire that the tree had to endure. And what trees can tolerate is, it really varies by the diameter of the tree. And that's what you'll see in the book, is depending on diameter, we figure it can survive different heights. So this is the duff consumption piece of it. So and this really measures how much organic material was removed and what the depth is. It doesn't really specify what the injuries are. So you're assuming injury from the amount of duff consumption, and investigations have shown that it's a predictive, it works for predicting mortality. So on the left, that's a really light consumption. You can see that some of the shrubs even still have leaves on them. There's a lot of debris still on the ground. So that was a light burn. On the right, that's really a close-up of the picture I showed you before. Burned out stump hole, not very much debris left, lots of white ash. So almost no duff left. So those are the factors that we found make a difference. And you can predict tree survival using those factors. We're still doing research on this. And in fact, we have a paper that I hope is coming out this year with lots and lots of measurements from Eastern Washington. So this will be local information with local tree species, and also validating the variables, and it's a longer term study than we had before. So a full 5 years of all of these trees, and what we do know has reconfirmed the old measurements that by far most of the mortality occurs in the first year, and by year four, we're really not getting fire mortality anymore. We may still trees may still be weak and they may die from other things, but they're not dying from fire injury anymore. Yeah, regionally specific, and then just get some larger sample sizes. And I wanted to show you this, because we talked about this last night in Nancy's presentation, so I found this over by 10 Mile, and Nancy, you were talking about this. This is, I found this lodgepole pine that had burned and then fallen, and that's a brand new germinant this year's. And there's lots of them out there by 10 Mile. Most of them will not survive through the year. But there are thousands of them out there now. And if there are hundreds that survive, well, that's why trees throw out all that seed. So that they can...
I'm wondering if that the deer browse those.
I don't think deer will browse something this small, because that's pretty tiny, but birds. Birds will come. Nutcrackers will really like little germinates. And then, of course, as it gets droughty in the summer, a lot of them will just succumb to the drought. But that one looks like it's in a pretty protected place.
Why do you think it won't survive?
Well, they, not all of them are going to make it. Birds will come and take them, and then drought will take a lot of them. I don't know about that one in particular, but just statistically, there are thousands of them out there now, and you actually don't want them all to survive, because then they'd be growing up like grass. I've seen this happen with lodgepole pine, where very many of them survived, and you get to the point where you have about a foot between each tree.
Yeah.
And yeah, we call it dog hair.
I would suspect that there isn't a lot of biological material on the ground for it to feed from, for one thing, as far as the seedling is concerned, but I also feel like it's a heat source as far as drought. You know, it's more exposed to the sun.
Yeah.
Is another reason, I think.
Yeah. Although lodgepole is the most, such a forgiving tree when it comes to growing on poor sites, which is why it's that early successional species. It can be a prepare sites for other species.
Can you say a little bit about how much does ash contribute to the nutrition of the forest floor?
Oh, quite a bit. Yeah, that ash layer, in fact, sometimes foresters will, after logging, burn a site, and that will make it easier to plant for one thing, but it will also release the nutrients. It's a quick release of nutrients.
How does drought pre-fire play in as a factor with all these other factors in terms of tree survivability?
Right. Well, the tree then would have been under stress before the fire. And so it does, and that might be a hard thing, that might be a hard call to make when you're going out and saying what was the overall tree vigor. Mm-hmm. So you know they were drought stressed, that's just something you'd have to keep in mind. So would anybody like to go out and take a look at some of these trees? That's really the most fun part for me.